Hi, I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a subject that is, it's not fun to talk about, but it's absolutely essential for our country's future and prosperity and security and freedom. And that is the foreign policy challenges facing the Trump administration as it begins its term in office. And I'm joined for that conversation by a very good friend of mine personally, and Ashbrook board member, longtime Ashbrook friend, Ashbrook alum, scholar, Dr. Rebecca Heinrichs. Rebecca has, you are one of the leading national security experts in the country, at least in my opinion. I think in the opinion of a lot of others, particularly on national security and ballistic missile defense. So appreciate you taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and I always warn people, you know, I'm honored that people think I'm influential, except that things are so bad. I just want to say that people are not taking my advice, which is why things are so bad.
We won't hold you responsible for their failures. Right, let's just cut to it. What are the most important challenges or threats facing the Trump administration in foreign policy and national security?
Sure. Well, I think the big thing to keep in mind is really we have a growing axis of adversaries that are increasingly collaborating with the goal in mind to replace the United States and our system of alliances with leaders that are authoritarian and antithetical to the American way of life. And that axis is led, it's always an axis is led by the country that has the most, you know, power, mm-hmm. in the form of economic power and military power. So in this case, it's the Chinese Communist Party. And the axis then is it's China, it's Russia, it's North Korea, and it's the Iranians. And each country, very different specific strategies in their near regions, but increasingly collaborating when they overlap to harm the United States, our deployed troops, and our allies.
All right, so let's take that first one that you mentioned, China. The Chinese Communist Party, what kind of a threat does it in fact pose to the United States right now?
Well, it's all-encompassing. So because the United States is so entwined with the Chinese economy, and China's purchasing power is massive. And there's an economic element where China has enormous leverage over, well, it seeks leverage over the United States because of our mutual vulnerabilities economically with each other. And of course, it also has critical rare earth minerals that are essential for the United States in that region near China. And then we've got crucial things that we rely on here in the United States, pharmaceuticals. Penicillin is predominantly made in China. And then, of course, it has a massive military that it's been resourcing specifically with the intent to push the United States out of the region, but then for the United States to simply, you know, be able to be coerced by the Chinese military. And the last point I'll say is that's all of its means, means that it could harm the United States, leverage over the United States to harm the United States. But it's really motivated by a Marxist-Leninist ideology held by Xi Jinping, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party, who believes that China should lead the world, not the United States. And so, and he has said himself that his heroes are Stalin and Mao. And so we have to understand the sincere ideological motivation behind China's adversarial approach towards the United States.
So is the Chinese Communist Party like the Soviet Union in its global imperial ambitions, or is it somehow different from that regime?
It's a bit different in its approach. So the Cold War that Reagan successfully led us through without it going hot is in many ways simpler. And for one of the reasons here that you could at least see that the Soviets did have this world domination element and approach towards what their imperialistic ambitions. The Chinese Communist Party is a little bit different in that it's trying to make a world safe for Chinese communism in China. So it's not as overt in how it approaches domination over other countries. But it does seek leverage over other countries. And then there's this soft totalitarianism that takes place once a country is very vulnerable to China, where China then can engage in censorship or anything in that country that Xi Jinping deems threatening to the regime in China. Because like all totalitarian countries, one of the most dangerous things for Xi Jinping is the fact that his people have to collaborate and cooperate. It's the world's most sophisticated techno-authoritarian state, you know, where there is surveillance everywhere and everything that inside, you know, the people inside China say or do or write is monitored, and you could be penalized for it. You have a social credit score, essentially. Mm-hmm. And if you say things that are bad about Xi Jinping or about the history of the Chinese state, you could have demerits, and that could affect how you could live in China. So it has this really strict, hard control over the Chinese people. And then that's why Xi Jinping is so concerned about the outward message of China. And in fact, some of these AI programs that people are looking at now, you know, you can't even write anything about Tiananmen Square. You can't even write anything about Tibet. You can't write about any of these things, or you can't criticize Xi Jinping on them. It's simply censored because the algorithms that are controlled inside China simply forbid it. It's why TikTok can't exist in China, because
That's ironic, right?
It can be in the United States because it's subversive in the United States, but China wouldn't allow a subversive, you know, social media app to exist in China because it would threaten the regime.
How did we get here? Because I think a lot of Americans, if you think of Richard Nixon's approach to, you know, opening up of U.S.-China relations, in part to offset, counterbalance against the Soviet Union, right? And then the admission of China into the World Trade Organization in the early 90s, and the idea that, look, China is not a threat. China is a strategic partner, and maybe even eventually some kind of friendly nation with us. That was certainly the thought 30 years ago. What happened?
Well, I mean, a lot of ideas took hold, and ideas have consequences. And one of those ideas was that, just as you said, that if we help China rise, and if we bring China into the global community of responsible nations conducting trade with one another, that China will simply want to be wealthy and would want that capitalism. The benefit of capitalism and an open society necessary for capitalism for growth, to bring a country out of enormous poverty and to make it a contributing global actor. Mm-hmm. But there is this, you know, there's a tendency of Americans to believe that they would want what we would want. Let's just all just trade and have strong economies and mind our own business, you know, and enjoy music and right. And enjoy leisure, and that's not what Xi Jinping had in mind. Xi Jinping came to power, and he's still a Marxist and a Leninist, and he grew up living through the Cultural Revolution, and rather than being against it, understood that the way out of this is to be the one on top. And so if you read some of Xi's speeches, I mean, he's a Marxist Leninist, and he believes that China was, you know, China's rightful place is to lead. And it doesn't, so this, the U.S.-led order, when we talk about the U.S.-led order, we talk about the post-World War II order. So it is democratic nations collaborating with the United States to have peaceful trade. We understand what responsible behavior is under sea and outer space and in, you know, global commons. We have an understanding. And we thought that even our adversaries would benefit from this set of understanding. You know, you can't have pirates. You're going to have free trade. Nobody owns these international waters. Well, China never agreed to that. They went along with it when they didn't have the capacity to do anything about it. And now that China has the capacity to do something about it, it doesn't believe that the U.S.-led international order is conducive to its interests. They want to be on top, and they want to shape a world that enables Xi Jinping to have much more influence over global events.
Obviously, one of the flashpoints, major flashpoints in the U.S.-China relationship is Taiwan and the status and future condition of Taiwan. What challenge does that pose now to the Trump administration?
Well, this is a very big challenge because President Trump has enormous pressure to reestablish deterrence that has been lost over the last 4 years during the Biden administration, which things, I think, just objectively speaking, the threat environment has gotten far worse over the last 4 years. And so we see largest land war in Europe with Russia's unprovoked aggressive actions, full invasion of Ukraine, extremely aggressive Chinese behavior against treaty ally the Philippines, very belligerent against Philippine fishermen, cutting undersea cables in the Baltic Sea all the way up in Europe. You saw the Chinese spy balloon that just brazenly flew across the United States, and we believe that they're surveilling in other ways as well. And so the Iranians attacked Israel directly for the first time with this massive missile attack, and then, of course, we're funding proxy. So things have really fallen apart over the last 4 years. And so I think the Trump administration now has to assess, okay, what are our biggest challenges? How do we reestablish deterrence so that our adversaries fear and respect the United States again? And what are our big areas where we really have to prevent these things from going south even worse? And Taiwan is going to be one of them. I mean, if China takes Taiwan, it will push the United States out of what has to this point been free international waters, essential for global trade, global commerce. And if the United States is pushed out of that because China now has essentially a forward position, essentially an aircraft carrier in the form of what is now democratic Taiwan, full of individual people who want to be self-determining and not Chinese communists, it can push the United States out and prevent us from being able to credibly make good on our treaty obligations we have with the Japanese and the South Koreans as well. So portends really bad things for American power and influence in the world.
You mentioned this kind of idea of an axis, which does suggest some kind of coordination between countries like China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. What evidence do we have of collaboration or coordinated efforts of any kind?
So it's really interesting. So even just a few years ago, if I were to call it an axis, people would say, it's a little premature, Becca. We can see budding, increasing collaboration. You're seeing a little bit of it, but surely China does not have an interest in Russia being a belligerent nation. That would be bad for global commerce, et cetera. And they're too different. How could China collaborate with the Russians? You know, and that, so there's this, there was this sort of bias against that notion in the professional sort of expert community and national security. But the evidence has just become sort of overwhelming. So I'll just kind of give a couple of examples. So, you know, China is getting rich off of the war of Russia's war in Ukraine, because you've got it's increasingly collaborating, and the Russians are now buying things from China and vice versa. China's of course not abiding by any sanctions against the Russians, et cetera, and China is supplying component parts to the Russians that they're using for the war machine in Ukraine. So they're not overt, you know, weapon systems. They know enough not to, you know, give them full on missile systems and missile batteries, because that could galvanize increased collaboration support among the West against China. But they're doing enough that you can see that a lot of these things, these critical component parts that the Russians are using to build their weapons are coming from China, and the Ukrainians have found that. But that's not all. I mean, the Russians are collaborating with the Chinese on other elements of the Chinese nuclear program, have been confirmed publicly by the Pentagon. And then you look over here at the Iranians. The Iranians have essentially become a drone factory for the Russians' war against Ukraine. And really, the IRGC supplying and training the Russians on drones to use against Ukraine.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Israelis have done the world a great favor in destroying a lot of the drone factories in Iran, but up until this point, Iran was very active in helping the Russians. And then last, I would point out, the North Koreans remarkably struck a deal with Russia. Putin went to North Korea and sat down with Xi Jinping, or with Kim Jong-un, and they have a partnership where Russia would invest in. We don't know to the extent of Russia's investment in what North Korea wants, but we do know that North Korean soldiers are now fighting on behalf of the Russian military against Ukraine, and so you see these just things that have just been unprecedented up into this in this recent time, and it seems to be growing. It's all trending in the wrong direction, And you know, look, it's really all shaped. It's all directed towards this idea of weakening the United States and any partner and ally that the United States is supporting.
Well, so it's interesting to me that on the military side, right, we were talking about that kind of collaboration that you see, which was astonishing to me to see, for example, North Korean troops in Ukraine fighting on behalf of the Russians. One of the things that President Trump did when he immediately took office was issue an executive order, and it's been sort of dubbed Iron Dome for America. Mm-hmm. Because you've been talking about conventional forces and conventional war, an invasion of Taiwan or the Russian invasion of Ukraine, ground forces, conventional forces. Of course, one of your areas of specialty is ballistic missile defense and more broadly missile defense. Were you surprised by this notion of an Iron Dome for America? And how does it fit into the challenges that America faces in defense against ballistic missiles?
Okay, so one thing is, not surprised, because President Trump actually has been talking, he's actually been very, very remarkably consistent about the country's need to have a missile defense since the 90s. Like, young Trump would do these interviews with Wolf Blitzer and talk about, you know, he was very adamant that the threat from nuclear weapons should be one that occupies the minds of our most senior policymakers, that it's such a serious problem. And so he would argue that the United States should consider preemptively taking out North Korea's developing at the time nuclear program, and we should always try diplomacy. But we should absolutely have as a backup plan, essentially, a robust missile defense system. And he thought Ronald Reagan was right about this, about having a missile defense system. Well, you know, fast forward to today, it's all the more true now. When the more complex the threat environments are, the more you want to buy insurance. And what better way to do that? If you watch what's going on with Israel, Israel has been able to, you know, people will say, like, Israel has been overly, you know, aggressive towards Hamas, or, you know, whatever the criticism is. Well, one of the reasons Israel up until this point has been able to be restrained in some regard against a constant threat of Palestinian terrorism is because of Iron Dome. Iron Dome has been intercepting these rockets, and so Israel has not had the destruction, not had the casualties, which would motivate it to go on and launch a ground invasion. Now, when you have missile defense system like that, you don't have to remain restrained. You can intercept missiles and still retaliate to impose a cost on the aggressor so that he doesn't do it again. Israel has chosen not to do that, really. And so now, I mean, so you've seen the success that missile defense buys decision makers time and space to decide how they want to respond, and then to act on terms more favorable to their decision makers. And so President Trump has watched that, and he calls it Iron Dome for America. And critics will say, oh, you know, what does he know? We can't have that particular system for the United States, because it's Iron Dome is made for shorter range rockets coming in, made for its geography. He's not talking about that specific technology. You know, President Trump is speaking in a brand. He's branding it. Everybody knows what he means. Average Americans, I should say, know what he means. He means we should have a defensive system because we know what Iron Dome is for Israel. And the executive order that he signed was really quite brilliant in that it laid out a layered approach to missile defense. It's not even going to be one system. But in it, he said it should have some space-based components, and that's really smart because that's where you're going to get the most effective, cost-effective technology for the sophisticated threats that Russia and China have against the United States. And he said we're no longer going to remain vulnerable to peer nuclear powers like Russia and China for this notion of stability, their mutual vulnerability between these countries. You know, the Russians have been building their own missile defense system, and the Chinese are building one as well. And so I think I think that especially with the complexity of the missile threats facing the country, it makes a lot of sense to make this a national priority.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
Some people, some of our historically minded listeners would think back, wait a minute, I've heard this before. Strategic Defense Initiative, the Reagan era. Is it like that?
I mean, it is. And I've argued even that a lot of the technology, Brilliant Pebbles, the Strategic Defense Initiative, not exactly the same, but there's some similarities of the technology. Now, it was very expensive at the time because we didn't space launches to get satellites up in space. It was very, very costly, very expensive. Well, with Elon Musk has shown us with SpaceX that actually if you unleash American ingenuity and allow the private sector to do it, that it can actually do things much more cost effectively than the government can in some cases. And so I think we have a model in what we've seen with Starlink and SpaceX that gives us sound reason to believe that we could actually have something like SDI, and not exactly the same, but similar at a cost that is manageable for the American people.
One of the challenges, even if you're thinking about ballistic missile defense, is coordination with other countries. So, for example, you have to have defensive launchers in places like Poland mm-hmm. or somewhere else. One of the questions that has been raised about Trump administration foreign policy is, should they connect American national security to continuing our alliances? Mm-hmm. So should we continue alliances, the NATO alliance? Is it still worth it? Should we continue alliances with South Korea, with Japan, with Australia, with other important countries around the world? What do you think about that question?
Well, I would just say, it's not a matter of altruism. The United States is the mightiest country in the world still, but our power relative to China has diminished, and so now whenever you look at the axis, for the first time in history, the United States will be facing two nuclear peers. During the Cold War, we faced one. It was the Soviet Union, but now we have Russia and China. China's in the midst of a nuclear strategic breakout, so they're advancing their nuclear program. They've until this point had a very small number of nuclear weapons, but they're advancing their nuclear program dramatically. And the analysis shows that they almost certainly want to be a peer to the United States at this time that Xi Jinping wants to be the preeminent power. And it's coming up. It's within the next, I would argue 5-6 years. And so when you have that kind of complex threat set where you have to now deter and make a nuclear force adequate to deter both of those countries simultaneously, you also have to have active defenses. And active defenses bolsters deterrence because it complicates the adversary's calculations. So he might think, I might think that I can attack the United States with just a small scoped attack sufficient to make the American people paralyzed with fear, so that we then say, forget it. That ally country over there is not worth it. Mm. If it means that we're going to be engaged in this kind of war with a major nuclear power. So that kind of concern, that's a coercive threat of a very limited, it doesn't even have to be nuclear, but a conventional missile strike on U.S. soil by the Chinese Communist Party, I mean, that's shockingly horrible to even think about, or the Russian Federation when you know they have this massive nuclear force. And so they wield enormous coercive power to have that ability. Now, I should say, I always say this, for any adversary that might be listening in, I don't think that would paralyze the American people and cause us to retreat. I think it would anger the American people.
Historically, it has not done that, right?
Historically, it has not paralyzed us with fear. It has awoken the giants, and we are very good at war fighting, and they should not go down that path. But I don't want them to have to find out that way, because I don't want the United States to be attacked, and I don't want to engage in a war with a major nuclear power. So we have to get on the left side of that timeline, and you want to build a defensive system such that they think they're not going to be able to get off a limited strike like that to paralyze us but not enrage us. And that's the art of deterrence. So you always want to spend a lot, you want to spend a lot on deterrence so that you never have to get into that fight to begin with.
So things like NATO, for example.
Yeah.
Some people have said, NATO isn't... It's outmoded. We don't have the Soviet Union anymore. Why do we need it? And our NATO allies are not doing what they should in upholding their end of the treaty bargains. Right. Things like percentage of GDP spent on defense. Yeah. What do you say to that?
A couple things. So the last point, just to, we can't handle all of these threats by ourselves. We're a strong, mighty country, but we actually do really need, we need the economic strength, the collaboration, the cooperation, the geography of our allies to be able to come along with the United States, because, you know, the U.S.-led world order since World War II that has benefited the United States, that benefited Americans, has relied on a lot of great dynamic trade with open societies, with democracies. And that's been good for the United States and has kept authoritarian imperialists at bay. And so we just can't take care of all the threats on our own. And if we want to have prosperity here at home, President Trump gave a great gave great remarks at the World Economic Forum where he was talking about how he wants increased trade. He wants NATO allies to spend more, if not even just 3%, not even just 2% of GDP on defense. He wants 5% now. Because he wants NATO to be strong. He doesn't want the United States. He wants the United States to shoulder less and them shoulder more. And I think that there's wisdom there. That doesn't mean that the United States, I mean, the United States has a great interest in NATO being strong so that we can avoid war and conflict and blood and treasure. And we do want to have economic prosperity. But the only way that you get peaceful trade, which you want for your economy, is if you have free and open international waters, and our adversaries are threatening specifically those. I mean, we're talking about this growing axis. I mean, Russia is helping the Houthis. I mean, you see, and so you have the Russians supporting terrorist proxies abroad because it advantages Russia and it hurts the United States and our allies. Mm. And so, yet NATO is the most successful political military alliance that has ever existed. And I believe it still is absolutely necessary today. We don't have the Soviet Union, but we do have Vladimir Putin and people who agree with him, who believe in this idea of this greater Russia. And it's just, you know, when Tucker Carlson interviewed Putin, I actually thought it was wonderful because it laid bare sort of Putin's motivations. And Putin, in the interview, he went back when he was asked, why are you doing this? And he went back to the 9th century in his explanation.
Wow.
And so you have to understand your adversary as your adversary understands himself. And he believes that certain peoples and nations are rightfully Russia's, and they're not. And so I think we have to understand that Putin's goal is to undermine the United States and break the United States' alliances, which have been a boon for economic prosperity and peace and security for the American people.
One of the other challenges that you have talked about, national security challenges facing the United States, is not a military or political issue exactly, but an economic one. You've talked about the importance of America having the manufacturing capacity. Mm-hmm. To build its own weapon systems and everything that is necessary beyond just immediate weapons to conduct successful foreign policy. Talk to us about the national security importance of American enterprise and manufacturing.
Sure. So it's really hard to de-link economics and your military ability. I mean, because your economy is your engine that enables you to produce the materials and the manufacturing to make the weapon systems that you need. And so right now the United States is very slow. It's very slow, it's highly regulated, the Pentagon's highly regulated, and we simply don't have the workforce currently in place necessary. So if we found ourselves with an aggressor attacking the United States or a critical area of interest to the United States, you know, we want to have the production capacity to build the necessary weapons at scale. And that to have that, you have to have trained builders already in place. And you can't start look around and realize that, you know, we actually don't have the workforce to do that. And so this has been really since the Cold War, when both Republicans and Democrats have essentially thought that we could replace and, you know, supplant hard power as our means of deterring major power conflict and our ability to have that hard power, so our manufacturing base, we could replace that with just trade. But You can't, because our adversaries are motivated by things other than just economic advancements. They have ideologies that are contrary to the United States, and so and they seek to harm us. And so that's why I think it's also, you know, that's been one something that that President Trump has talked about quite a bit. Vice President Vance has talked about that quite a bit, about rebooting American manufacturing so that we have a robust defense industrial base, so that we have the capacity to defend ourselves should we find ourselves in that problem. But that also bolsters deterrence. I mean, if our adversaries know that we couldn't produce a bunch of bombers and tankers quickly like we did in World War II, like we couldn't do it. I mean, that's a problem. So we need to get at it and make sure that we're, you know, making sure that we're educating, you know, the people with the necessary skill sets to be able to build a workforce to produce these weapons that we need. And we can do it. I mean, we surprise ourselves. I mean, when Russia first invaded Ukraine, we didn't have these artillery shells that we needed to supply Ukraine. We didn't have a sufficient number to keep supplying them, 155 millimeter rounds. We've been remarkably able to grow the workforce quickly for those plants that were producing those. So when we need to, when we're motivated, we can get on it and make hard necessary changes. It's just that it's much smarter to do that now before we're in a really tight spot.
So you've outlined a lot of these big challenges. These are big, complex, difficult, deep challenges. They're going to require a lot of effort politically. They're also going to perhaps require some sacrifice from the American people. Are you optimistic that the United States can rise and successfully face these foreign policy challenges?
Totally optimistic. I'm confident that the United States can do it. I mean, we are still a wealthy nation. We're a dynamic nation. I'm excited about the energy surrounding the new administration. It seems to be quite clearly a rejection of American decline and an embrace of American ascendancy. And then it's just, how do we wield this new energy and excitement to make sure that we're prioritizing the things that we really need to? And there's lots of things that we want to do here at home and building infrastructure, et cetera. But, you know, we have to prioritize rebuilding the defense industrial base. We have to prioritize reestablishing deterrence. And so I'm optimistic that that's the direction that this administration is headed. But you know, you need strong leaders in the cabinet officials to all together be articulating a message that the American people understands when we begin spending money on the defense, you know, industrial base again, when we start really investing in shipyards and producing more ships. The American people, I mean, we are the sovereign. And so these cabinet officials who get in there and see the briefings, they need to explain to the American people why this is a good use of our precious resources. And so that needs to happen. That has to happen. And the American people have to get behind that. Otherwise, you're not going to have a successful, you know, congressional collaboration with the administration to pass necessary budgets to get it done.
Very important advice. Thank you for taking the time to be with us, and look forward to more conversations as the administration goes forward.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.